Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me once again is my co-host, Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. I practiced that 7 or 8 times while I was doing sound checks, and I kept on saying environmental scientist and activist, which I think sounds incredibly cool, but I don't know if it's true.
It's not true, and actually, I don't think that you should call me an environmental scientist, because I don't have my PhD.
Yeah, but I'm not saying you're a doctor.
Well,
I'm saying you studied environmental science.
Well, that would be the correct phrase. Calling me a scientist it sort of implies a PhD.
Ooh. Do we need to come up with a new phrase for you?
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't think it's
to discuss this right now.
I don't think it's the hill to die on. But
good. All right. As long as you don't feel like you're misrepresenting yourself, or that I'm overinflating.
I don't think anyone's going to chase me down over it.
Anna joins me again today. After a long hiatus, we return to talk about Support Your Local Gunfighter, a comedy western that was released on the 26th of May in 1971, 50 years ago. This movie was given 1.5 stars by Roger Ebert, who called it possibly the worst western comedy of modern times. Roger Greenspun from the New York Times said that it had a plot too numerous to mention, and that the best actor in it was the donkey because he didn't have any lines. And lastly, Michael Kerbel from The Village Voice says that director Kennedy is so desperate to be funny that the audience does not laugh. Anna, what did you think about James Garner's comedy western and follow-up to his 1969 hit Support Your Local Sheriff, Support Your Local Gunfighter?
Yikes. Well, I didn't hate it as much as Ebert did. But he wasn't wrong. I read his review, and he got some points right. But man, is he a stinker sometimes, right? Like, okay, what a stick in the mud. Like, do you not want him at a party?
I assume that was early in his career. I don't have a good handle on the timeline of Roger Ebert, but yeah. I assume that 50 years ago, he was probably a fairly youngish critic.
Mm-hmm.
And I am willing to wager, based on my own personal life experience, that he was probably a bit more blood and thunder in his reviews early on. I bet he was much more beloved of what he loved and angry at things that disappointed him in terms of the raw potential of film. I'm literally just guessing. I've never been a Siskel and Ebert head. They were never part of my exposure to film reviews growing up, so I can't accurately say.
Yeah, that sounds plausible. I think that this film is, I mean, it's a fun romp, but it doesn't hold up super well, especially, I mean, I think that the thing to say really right out of the gate is that if you're gonna watch one of these movies, you should watch Support Your Local Sheriff.
Okay.
There, I said it.
I think that there's lots that's interesting about the relationship between these two movies.
Mm-hmm.
I have in front of me The Garner Files, James Garner's memoir. Just before he died, I was going through some of his pictures and found some quotations by him about acting in general. And he's one of that breed of actor that feels that acting is not an art, it's a craft. It's something that you show up and you do, and it's hard, and you should get paid for it, but that it's not something that should be celebrated. He's one of those guys that's just like, yeah, we get way more attention for this than we deserve.
Mm.
And anybody that's talking about method and the way in which you get into character is blowing it all out of proportion. Perhaps out of fear that somebody will notice that what they're doing is silly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was surprised that he'd written a book at all about his experiences, because it seemed like even that was generating more attention to the behind-the-scenes stuff than I thought that he would be interested in.
Well, didn't he dish? Wasn't it sort of like, didn't he, like, give the goss?
A little bit. He's known generally, as a straight shooter. That's and that isn't a Western pun. but he's generally considered to be one of those people who everybody liked, except for the people that he was honest about and told the truth about. The end of the book is something like 20 pages where he just goes through every film he's been in chronological order, rates it, and shares a couple of lines of memories about it. So, for example, here's a film he made in 1966 with the star of this movie, Suzanne Plachette, called Mr. Budwing. On IMDb, it summarized as it's about a man who loses his memory and has to figure out who he really is. And Garner's summary of the film is 0 stars. I'd summarize the plot, but to this day, I have no idea what it is. Worst picture I ever made. What were they thinking? What was I thinking?
He thinks he's so funny.
In Support Your Local Sheriff, he gives it 3.5 stars, and his memories of it are that for a long time after it came out, when people came up to me in public, this is the movie that they talked about. And when it's on TV, he says, I'll sit up and watch a little of it. And he talks about the production of it for about 3 pages in the memoir. For Support Your Local Gunfighter, he gives it 2 stars, and his summary is as follows. Not as good as Support Your Local Sheriff, and not really a sequel.
No, it's not really a sequel at all. Sorry, I have one question. So it's out of 5, right? The stars?
Yes. You're right, out of 5. He gives his favorite film. He's in interviews for years, he always said that his favorite of his films is The Americanization of Emily, which he made in 1964 with Julie Andrews. It was her second ever feature film, and they filmed it before Mary Poppins had come out.
Oh,
and so they didn't even know how big of a hit that was going to be.
So yeah, no, it's not a sequel, but you know, I will say when I was watching it, I thought of you because it felt Python-esque because the characters show up. So many of the same actors show up in not only both movies, but then when I went back to watch the TV show Maverick, the same actors showed up there too. at least one of them. I lost count of like all of these people, but, also, the comedy felt very modern, like, especially compared to a lot of the other movies that we've watched, which has been sort of like a more, I don't want to say serious, but more, yeah, no, actually, more serious, more sort of artful, I don't know, like...
This doesn't feel as 70s to you.
Yeah, maybe not as 70s, it's more absurdist, more, like, more one-liner sort of wordplay, punchy, fast-paced, really having fun with itself, whereas like some of the other ones that we've watched are more dreamy, what are they getting at, satire, critical theory sorts of things. Like, is this a comedy? I don't know.
Yes. Yeah, no, I love that. I love that take on it, is that when you're watching Brewster McCloud, when you're watching A New Leaf, these are movies that are nominally comedies, but don't necessarily make you laugh. They're absurdist in a way that there's the potential that you could be sitting there with your arms crossed going, I thought this was supposed to be a comedy, but I'm not tickled pink here.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie is so full of people who are shouting at each other and at the camera being like, it's a comedy! Like, they're playing it as broad as possible. The commentary track by Michael Schlesinger, he refers to a couple of the times of where the performances are so broad, and he says, well, it is a farce, of course. And I think that's one of the key aspects to it, is that it never attempts to really create much in the way of realism.
Right. Yes, a word that did not come to me while I was watching it, but is very... apt.
Here's one of his quotes from the commentary. He described the performance as controlled hamminess.
Sometimes uncontrolled.
Yes, I think controlled hamminess might be generous.
Yeah, and especially in the case of their female characters, completely off the rails, uncontrolled, as far out as they can take it.
Well, let us, just for novelty's sake, let's start with Support Your Local Sheriff. We don't need to summarize its plot, but... Garner preferred it. Critics preferred it. Ebert gave it a full half star more. that he gave to support your local gunfighter.
We don't love him, but he is a benchmark for the ages.
I might be the only person in the world that prefers support your local gunfighter.
Shut up. You do? Chair. Oh my gosh. Will you say why? Are we going to talk about it now or later?
Later.
Okay. All right.
But, so let's establish sheriff first so that then we can talk about the contrast.
Okay. Okay.
And support your local sheriff. I liked Ebert's review of it in that he basically said it's an hour and a half long sitcom. I felt that the plot was pretty slim. A guy shows up in town. They need a sheriff because the town is mildly falling apart. Like, it isn't dangerous, but it's unruly, it's muddy, and it's loud. And his character says, I'm not going to stick around. I'm going to Australia. But he volunteers in order to get paid in hopes that he would then have enough to make a stake in order to try and pan for gold. And then he cleans up that town and, against all rationality, falls in love with the only girl in the entire town, who also decides that she's going to set her hat for him. And then 13 bandits show up at the end, and there's supposed to be a street fight, and then he brings out a cannon to threaten them, and then they get married and live happily ever after. Is that a fair assessment of the plot?
Yeah. That was a good rundown.
What did you enjoy about that?
It was very charming. The characters are very charming. The plot was pretty tight. The jokes were fast, a good combination of plot relevant and ridiculous. Yeah, all of the characters had a distinct role to play in the plot. I think James Garner character was very, like, we like to watch him on screen from the outset. He's a character that we sort of like the archetypal, like, good cowboy. He's good with his gun. Or is he? No, he is. He's actually like...
Yes, there's a key scene where he throws a washer up in the air in the general store and claims to have shot a bullet through the hole in the washer. And the people that he's trying to impress say, you could have just missed the washer. And so they put a piece of adhesive tape over the hole, and he shoots, and it falls back down, and there's definitely a hole through the adhesive tape. And they all... suddenly get real scared of offending him and worried that, oh my god, this guy could kill all of us without blinking. Despite the fact that he appears to be a very genial, open-faced guy the whole time. Like, never really comes across as angry or violent, but they react to him like he's the scariest person they've ever met because of this.
I was rolling through the whole movie. I don't know. Like, that setup, it was just, like, it was surprising. I don't know why it was so surprising. Like, every little joke that they set up, and we were all familiar with the idea of, like, throwing something up into the air and shooting it mm-hmm. in the air and looking at the hole. Mm-hmm. But the idea of, like, throwing a washer up in the air and shooting it, like, it was good. It was stupid. A lot of them were, like, kind of stupid, but, like, fun.
And there are two excellent jokes in that scene. There's the joke in the middle when he's got the tape over the washer and he you know, he's handed it back. They're like, prove yourself. He's like, I already shot one hole in your like, he's sort of pointing out the absurdity of them asking for this again. He's already heard the score. And then afterwards, they're so excited, they give him the sheriff's badge. And there's a dent in it from where it got shot, the previous owner. And he goes, wow, it looks like it must have saved the guy's life. And the mayor or the head of the town council goes, yeah, it would have too if it wasn't for all those other bullets coming at it.
That's what I mean. It's just like wall-to-wall jokes. Oh man, you can even catch them all. And
just like that sheriff caught all those bullets.
And I was very torn while I was watching it. I was like, is this modern humor? There's I think it was in the sheriff movie where the mayor's like kind of showing around his office and he's like, and this is the room where I do my mayoring work. And it was just like sort of like a throwaway line. But it was very quirky and it felt like it would have been like more in place in sort of like a Parks and Rec scene. Mm. But then a lot of the other stuff, I felt more like it was almost like more of a a vaudeville kind of like fast paced, like one liner, like witty and absurd at the same time. So I was torn of like, what is this era? Like, what does this mean? Why do I love this? You know, is this the Marx Brothers or is this the modern dry, fast, absurd? And I guess it's both. I don't know.
Dry is a great word. It's presented, particularly Garner, is ordinary and normal. His voice and his delivery very rarely escalates. He's sort of talking to you like anybody in the world would talk to everybody else, and everybody around him is just a little bit off. It's like a normal guy walked into Westworld, except instead of it being genuine, real old-timey West, it's like fake comedy old-timey West, and like you sort of have to interact with all these robots, and then you're sort of never quite sure what's supposed to be happening. It has that odd quality of asynchronous communication. The guy who does the commentary for the track, he consistently points out that what he thinks is funny about Support Your Local Sheriff is that Garner is practical and isn't willing to submit to cliches, whereas everybody else is in a Western, and they're just doing the things that Westerns do. And Garner is like, or we could think about this for a second and not just do it because it's what's expected.
I definitely was wondering, like, are they skewering? Like, is this like the Scream of like 1969 Western? You know, where it,
like... I don't think it's a total deconstruction, but I think that that's an excellent comparison. Yeah, mm-hmm. They're aware that this is existing in a set of Western expectations, and that they're playing with them every so often. Mm-hmm. So the film cost $7,500,000 to make, and according to Garner's memoir, it was the first movie that he produced. Cherokee Pictures, the production company of Support Your Local Sheriff, was created by Garner, who is 1/4 Cherokee and was fairly proud of it. It was successful enough that they literally got the band back together. They have the exact same director who'd done a comedy in the middle called Dirty Dingus McGee, and
that's not a real movie.
And the gods. I've never seen it, but definitely a real thing.
Is it a comedy? Is it a comedy Western?
Yes.
Oh my god. We're watching that next.
That stars Jack Elam, the guy who played his deputy in Sheriff and fake Shifty Morgan in Support Your Local Gunfighter.
Is he Dirty Dingus McGee?
I believe he's the titular Dirty Dingus McGee.
I don't know if I can hang.
But it was popular and successful enough. I wasn't able to find any final numbers as to what the gross was for Support Your Local Sheriff, but it was apparently incredibly successful. And Garner talks about that for years. People talked to him about it. It must have been a hit. And so they brought everybody involved back. Now, the director, Kennedy, was already starting to get a reputation for having a stock group of actors, which is why pretty much everybody except the female lead is somebody who's been in the previous movie. Mm-hmm. And these are also people that have been in at least some of the 10 other Westerns that he directed. And they would just crank them out. The commentator talks about the idea that when you have that kind of a character troupe, you're not really writing characters so much as you're writing actors. And you know, okay, this guy can do this in his sleep, and so therefore we can get this on time and on budget because this is the kind of performance they're going to give.
Which is fun. That's part of the fun of watching it, is that like it has that chemistry of like, you know, I was saying before, like Monty Python or like watching Super Troopers with like the Broken Lizard crew. Like it has the energy of banter. And I think that that, like, for everything you can say about it, you know, call it like an hour and a half long sitcom, whatever you want to say, Ebert, trash on it, it's a throwaway film, that's fine. But it does have like a fun and a levity to the comedy, I think.
1971 comes around and we release Support Your Local Gunfighter. I don't have the cost of what it cost to make. That was a terrible sentence. I don't have the budget for it. I do, however, have what IMDb claims it grossed in the United States, which was $551,500, a full $200,000 less than Support Your Local Sheriff costs to make. Mm. So, by all accounts, therefore, it sounds like a failure.
But you think it's
Anna
better.
Anna has leant forward conspiratorially. She is staring at the camera with her hands tucked under her chin. This is an interrogation now.
Yes, now is the time that you're going to tell me why you think it's better or why you like it more.
Two essential reasons. The first of which is I like the fact that Garner's character, Latigo Smith, is selfish and a switch from his normal character. And I think this is one of the reasons why audiences at the time didn't like it, mm-hmm. is they wanted Maverick. Mm-hmm. And yet he shows up in his Maverick costume.
Yeah.
Even more so than Sheriff, where he's basically wearing a corduroy jacket. But in this, he's got the specific skinny tie and the fluffy pirate shirt and a waistcoat with elegant embroidery. He is dressed as the color version of Maverick. And he does not act like Maverick. He has none of the patience. He has none of the wit. He has none of the wryness and flamboyant flexibility that Maverick has. He is, in fact, a big old selfish jerk. He's nice with money. He's perfectly willing to hand out money to anybody because he doesn't care. But he's not great as a person.
Sarsaparilla.
What?
Well, I would write it down, but I don't figure you could read it. Soda pop.
Don't hardly anybody ever want soda pop.
Don't you drink? Only to be sociable, and I don't feel sociable right now.
And I thought that was funny.
It's fun, but is it, like, as funny? Do you feel like the quantity and quality of jokes were there compared to Sheriff?
And then the second part of that is everybody else. Hmm. Everybody else in Support Your Local Gunfighter gets more to do. Hmm. In Support Your Local Sheriff, the other characters are just there as sketches. But every single one of those character actors gets their own little story in a way that they didn't necessarily have in Sheriff.
Satisfied?
I will be when you stop sneaking off with that Taylor Barton and riding that damn bicycle.
We haven't been riding in over a week. Taylor's got a flat.
And I was more entertained with the random weirdness of all of those stories than I was with their paper-thin facsimiles of being there just in order to make the sheriff look good. I mean, don't get me wrong. The part played by Bruce Dern, the gunfighter who's locked up in the prison without bars in Sheriff, that was brilliant.
Oh my god, it was so good!
But none of the other characters were at all interesting, but they didn't work. I suppose,
what about,
you know,
his family that comes to rescue him? That was, yeah. You didn't like that? You didn't like the dad talking to the sons, and the sons were like, but dad, we run this town!
Little bit. And that's interesting, because that's one of the things that Garner talks about specifically, is that character is played by an actor named Walter Brennan. And it's his last ever movie. Okay. And he is a legendary actor. And I think Garner was excited to have this chance to work with this legend. I think his memories of hanging out with him on set probably influenced his feelings about that was a good experience. And there's nobody of that level of quality in this. I think the scenes with the sons talking to him and sort of being, like, there's this really bizarre scene in Sheriff where one of the sons is like, hey, are you doing something different with your hair? It doesn't connect. It's not predicated on anything. It's never followed up on. It's just this weirdness. Those little moments of the familial awkwardness, that those were very real. And they were underplayed, and I liked them. Nothing in Gunslinger is underplayed. Everybody is shouting constantly. Everybody is over the top.
Now get out of here. I got bins to tend to.
Anybody ever tell you you've got a rotten bedside manner? Out! And you talk too much! And I can't understand you!
It therefore crosses into a different lane of weirdness, and I found myself laughing at it more, even though it was less artful and more obvious, but because there was more of it.
Oh,
it's kind of the predecessor to Airplane in that way.
Okay, well, yeah, and that is a feeling that I got when I watched Gunfighter, is like it felt like we had jumped like suddenly 2 years forward, and it mm-hmm. felt like we were somewhere different with the comedy.
Yes,
yeah. Interesting, yeah. But I don't know, Ben, I've never seen you be this wrong before. Because think about all the things that are, like, running gags that aren't even that funny to begin with. Like, fire in the hole.
Yep, not funny.
Or the roulette gag, where, like, they do the first roulette gag, and, it's like, okay, you know he's going to win by the end. They're going to do it three times, yes. He's going to win the third time.
No good, doesn't work.
Yeah, they're bad. And, like, it was funny. I mean, it wasn't funny when he collapsed after losing the first time.
Nope.
But, like, these jokes, like, they just didn't hit for me.
I agree. Those jokes didn't work for me either.
But overall, the movie did better than Sheriff did.
Yeah.
Or the female lead. She was basically like Wile E. Coyote.
This is interesting. I'm interested in the reactions to the female lead. Now, the part in Sheriff is played by a woman named Joan Hackett.
Yeah.
And I don't have anything down about her career. The commentary track says that she was a moderately difficult actress and was hard to work with. Garner, in his memoir, does not agree with that. He says, I loved Joan. She was in the Jean Arthur League of Comedic Actresses and was just a funny woman. And then leans in and addresses the difficulty part briefly by saying, they were complaining about her until I finally said, you can reshoot anything you like, but we're not getting rid of her. Mm-hmm. Like, went to bat for her, kept her as his lead. Mm-hmm. Suzanne Fleshette, who has an early appearance in The Birds as Tippi Hedren's dark-haired rival in 1963, the year after this is cast as Emily on The Bob Newhart Show, and is in all six seasons, all 142 episodes, and it's what she's most known for, as being part of one of the generally regarded funniest shows in the history of the television cinema. A show with which I am mostly unfamiliar.
Well, she might be really funny, but she wasn't funny in this. She just has the one joke that she keeps saying over and over again about how she wants to go to New York and go to the school for girls with nice families or whatever it is. You can splice the clip in later.
My pa gets killed, I'll never get back east to Miss Hunter's College on the Hudson River, New York, for young ladies, a good family.
On top of which, he'll be dead.
But it's not funny. Oh, and I mean, and the gag, her like physical gag, is that she's like slinking around like Wile E. Coyote trying to kill James Garner's character. And it is funny, but it's the same joke the whole movie, and I feel like she's completely underused. And
I don't think she, after she gets kicked out of the whorehouse, I don't think she tries to kill him again.
Oh, right. So, and then she is the love interest, which is also boring in just a different way. And it's like the similar plot device as in Sheriff, where they take one of the only, I don't know what the right word would be, to like the only marriageable women in town. Mm-hmm. And they make her, like, bananas. And they take it completely over the top, but then they fall in love at the end. And it's like, I'm not exactly sure why. Maybe it's just because that's, like, funny.
Now put him up, I'm going to kill you.
I don't see why I have to put my hands up for that.
You know, I just don't feel right about killing you stretched out in bed like that. Do you think you could maybe just jump up and try and grab me, and then I'd get mad and I'd light the fuse?
But it was also, like, really tedious. I don't know.
Yes, we're introduced to her character in the second scene, basically, in the film. We're in the town of Purgatory in Colorado. And the ostensible plot of the film is the same as A Fistful of Dollars, is that there are two rival gangs in the town. A stranger comes to town and manipulates them against each other for his own profit. Except it's a comedy of errors in that he's not actually a gunfighter. He's just pretending to be in order to make some dough, because he keeps on losing his money because he has an irrational desire to bet despite the fact that he knows that it's a really dumb thing to do. He claims that there's only an 8% chance of winning on any number on a roulette wheel, but he has a compulsion to put all of his money down on this one particular number. But every time he gets a nest egg, he blows it all on this over-the-top, irrational behavior. So two or three times in the, over the course of the movie, he has goes back to zero because he can't control his freakish, farcical impulses. Steps off the train, is hired by one of two rival managers of gold mines, each trying to get to be their gunfighter so they can get rid of the men that are preventing the mine from being open. And they're waiting for him to show up. And suddenly, Suzanne Fleshette's character starts shooting up the town because she just doesn't like people. And then later, she's talking to the doctor, who she claims is her only friend in town, and he admonishes her and says,
Patience, you gotta stop shooting at people. You know something? If you wasn't such a miserable shot, there wouldn't be a young man alive in all of purgatory.
Which, you know, I agree. On a fundamental level, guns are wrong and people shouldn't have them. But also, I believe that that is what a doctor should believe. But he also says, why were you shooting at people anyway? And she says something along the lines of, oh, well, you know, this guy had asked me to marry him. And the doctor says, that's not a good reason to shoot people. And she says, yes, it was. It was Elmer. Have you seen Elmer? And stalks off screen. And then this mutant, balding sack of humanity that we've seen who runs the dynamite store wanders by and says, hey, Doc. And Doc says, hey, Elmer. And it's a perfect joke setup. It is a 1, 2, 3, set him up, knock him down, elementary vaudevillian joke setup. And I cackled like a loon. It worked on every level.
I don't know. I guess so. I didn't think Elmer was so bad.
Well, I can't speak to Portland Tinder.
He might have been a little old for her, but he seemed nice. And in that whole rundown that you gave, you missed what I think is one of the best lines in the movie.
Oh, please.
When she opens fire on the town in like the beginning scenes, one of the characters is like,
the Sidewinder!
Your sister's name is Patience.
Yeah, not what anybody would call a high concept joke.
No, it's not a high concept joke. It's just funny.
No, I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying that nobody can point at this and say, yes, that is sophisticated humor. That you've named your romantic lead, who has a hair trigger, is named Patience. Not what anybody would dare call sophisticated in terms of its writing.
I just like the idea that the brother was calling his sister the Sidewinder.
Sidewinder.
It was a good gag.
With every episode, we're aiming towards getting to our five favorite moments.
I didn't have them. That was my only one. That was literally, I just took my only top five moment and gave it away in the middle of the show. Stop laughing.
I mean, I was anticipating that was going to be difficult based on your introduction that you didn't enjoy the film. I was going to be interested in talking around it. So now that we're cutting to the chase, you're just like, no. I had one favorite moment, and favorite is a strong word. I'm kind of fascinated by it. I think for me, the whole is definitely not successful. The resolution and the structure of the plot is dumb. But there were enough jokes in it that I did go along with it. And because the acting was less subtle and more broad, I didn't care that it didn't have a good plot to hang things on. I was just waiting for the next punchline. When you read a Far Side book, you're not interested in a story. You're just interested in the next gag. And to me, this movie was the rough equivalent of something like Airplane, something like Naked Gun, where you have a story just so that you can move on to the next dumb joke. But that the actual story itself isn't going to be funny.
I agree with you. I think that Sheriff did that better. And here it almost felt like the plot was more important Yeah, I'm like, who are these people? What is happening? Because I don't know if like the jokes weren't coming fast enough, or if I just didn't feel like they were hitting, or if there was like more to understand about the setup because of the plot. I don't know. I don't know what wasn't working for me.
Well, I want to go back to the idea that everybody else agrees with you. You have the position that's defensible.
Yeah, well, I guess I'll stop trying to explain myself then.
Yeah, I think you should stop taking the tone of, I don't know how to better explain the idea that I'm part of a majority opinion, Ben.
Yeah, why don't you explain yourself, your poor taste? Why don't you pick out some jokes that you thought were funny?
All right.
Let's hear your top moments.
So in chronological order, there's a line after Latigo Smith has just lost his first $4,600 by betting it all on number 23. And so he walks out into the street and he's broke and he hasn't figured out what he's going to do next. And Mr. Barton, the owner of one of the mines, comes up to him and says, "Young man, I'd like to offer you some work." And the natural thing to do in this circumstance when you're broke is to take this landline that's being offered to you, but in the curmudgeonly irritating way that I like that Gardner plays his character in this film, he blows him off. He angrily pushes him aside. And Jack-A-Lan, who's playing a character named Jug, calls him on it. He's the realistic voice in this and says, "Why wouldn't you take this guy's job offer?" And the line that James Gardner says is,
"I don't like work. It tires me out."
That's good.
It's sort of the inverse of that kind of sensibility that was in Sheriff, where he was the person that was commenting on the strangeness of the Western conventions. In this, he's playing a guy who is, I don't want to use the word anti-hero because I hate the phrase anti-hero, but he's playing somebody who is not doing what he's supposed to do. He's playing somebody who is resisting the temptation to be the heroic arc. And every chance he gets, he refuses the call. And I generally, therefore, like the idea that a person that is positioned by the movie to be the hero, his fundamental attitude is, "Ugh, I have to make an effort? God damn it." That, to me, is funny.
It is fun. And I did like that about the movie, but I think that the jokes still didn't hit. Like, I think that they could have hit and they didn't, and it was disappointing because I think I know what you mean, and
but they didn't work for you.
No, they just didn't get there.
Fair enough. Secondly, I was talking about the way in which I thought that the other characters were more interesting characters. And I think the main way in which that revealed itself over the course of the plot was the relationship between Mr. Morgan, Patience's dad, and the sister of the colonel. After the gunfighter who braces Latigo Smith in the store has to go back with his two broken fingers and report that it didn't go very well, Mr. Morgan says, "You know, well, I've got sources on this." And the gunfighter then gets this weird, random expositional moment where he says, "Yeah, we all know what your sources are. It's because you're," and he says, "marvelous word. I've never encountered any place else." He says, "You're sparking on her." "You're sparking on the colonel's sister." I can't remember if it's sparking on or sparking with.
"I have a way of knowing what goes on in the colonel's house."
"He's sparking the colonel's old maid sister. That's what. That's how he knows what's going on."
"Why, you young whippers.
I've seen you out bicycle riding with his sister."
Either way, it's a fascinating verb. And then you get these constant moments between the two. We're told that they're recreating the sexy bicycle scene from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But it's these two people in their 60s, and they're just so horny for each other.
Yeah.
And it makes me laugh. It makes me laugh that somebody was like, "You know what's funny? Old people having sex." Well, you can't show that. This is a G-rated movie. But let's just talk about it a lot. Let's just talk about how these two can't keep their hands off each other.
And no one wants them to be together. Everyone is
right.
Really upset about it.
Nobody wants to think about it.
Yeah, they were fun.
Number three, as I alluded to earlier, there's a scene where, as you called it, and I think that's a very good metaphor, Lady Patience is gone full Wile E. Coyote. She has met with the colonel's sister in order to get the worst disguise as a prostitute to sneak into Madame Jenny's place and find Latigo sprawled out on a bed eating breakfast, and she brandishes a naked stick of unlit dynamite exactly like Wile E. Coyote and threatens to blow them up. But she says, "Now put your hands up, I'm going to kill you." And he's eating breakfast in bed, and he very, in the same kind of stick-in-the-mud, grouchy way, says, "I don't see any reason why I should put my hands up for this." And his refusal to engage with her insane, violent paranoia in that scene just made me laugh. The whole bit of him just being like, "I don't know what this is, but I'm having breakfast, I just had sex, I'm good, so I'm just going to wait it out."
Yeah, that's going to be a nah for me.
Yeah, and so, again, as a scene in and of itself, that contrast between her freaky manic energy and his "I'm rubber, you're glue-ness" just really worked for me. And for my last one, the colonel, the brother of the horny old lady, for some dumb reason, they decide to write him as having a Napoleon complex. And there are two or three lines of dialogue about her saying, "I wish I'd never gotten him that book on Napoleon." And there's a bit where he sticks his hand in his jacket while standing in front of a picture of Napoleon, and none of it works. I love the fact that you're laughing about the memory of it or the description of it, because the joke itself simply doesn't land. Also, because the man is clearly 6'3". Like,
I'm just glad that we're revisiting all these jokes, because hearing you talk about them, they are funny, but watching them in the movie, I did not laugh.
So here's his great line. He's pissed off about the affair. He's pissed off about the fact that his mine isn't going to work. He's pissed off at the fact that the gunslinger scared away his enforcers from the mine. And so he decides that he's going to have his guys take Mr. Morgan out into the swamp and shoot him. And I don't remember who it is, whether it's Mr. Morgan or his sister, goes, "That's murder," in that tone of voice. Like, "How dare you?
My boys will take you out in a swamp and put a bullet through your thick head."
"That's murder!
I've studied law! Of course it's murder!"
That one was good. I did like that one.
It's not dissimilar to the kind of energy that Garner was bringing earlier to the scene. It's sort of like, why would you try to do this? It doesn't make any sense. Which is its own version of the same kind of humor dynamic that was in the previous thing. I do genuinely feel that my hot take on this movie is people didn't like it because Garner wasn't likable. Mm-hmm. And if Garner had been likable, it would have felt exactly the same as the other film. But because they went in a different direction, it didn't have the center that people could latch onto. And so, therefore, the humor didn't work.
I think you are partially correct. Like, it definitely was not as enjoyable.
That's very big of you.
You're welcome. Do we have room for one more favorite moment? Because I did remember one that I liked.
Please.
So when James Garner's character, Latigo, is courting Madame Jenny, and she takes him to buy a new hat, and he is aggressed upon by a bounty hunter. I'm not exactly sure who the character is, but somebody who approaches him and is sort of threatening him. And then he's like, "Well, let's take this out on the street." And the guy turns around to, like, go out on the street for a duel or whatever, and Latigo, James Garner character, is just like,
"You hit that fellow from behind.
Just as hard as I could."
And then James Garner's character picks up an iron and smashes his trigger finger, which to me was the most beautiful moment of his character coming into his own as this, as you would not say, anti-hero. He's clever, he's inventive, he is the con man. He is not going to fight this guy. He's going to do what he needs to do to solve his problems. And he apologizes to Madame Jenny. He's like, "Oh, I'm so sorry that you had to see that." And then Jackie Lom's character points out that it's the wrong trigger finger. The guy's actually left-handed, So he has to go down and break the guy's other trigger finger. But really, my favorite part of the scene is Jackie Lam. He's holding Madame Jenny's little dog, and he covers the eyes of the little dog when James Garner leans down to crush the other finger of this passed out guy. It's a gross scene. Like, it's, mm-hmm. It's not light, and it really does bring James Garner's character fully into his own as this bad dude, which is fun. And like I was saying, I do like that about this character, and I wish that they had, I don't want to say like flesh that out more, because we do see a lot about him with that. I just wish that it was like the scene where he's like shaming the people for playing roulette, and then he goes and finally plays it. It didn't hit the way that I wanted it to. Like, it wasn't quite as funny as I thought it could have been.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I think that the shaming of the roulette thing, there's an interesting bit with that, is that it's never stated outright, but it's clear that the other two guys at the roulette table, they're paid to play roulette, and they're just waiting for a prospective third person who's actually playing roulette to come in. Because they're always just leaning there, and then when somebody comes in, they like straighten up and pretend to play roulette. But like their whole bit is to make it look like the roulette table is the hot happening action in town. Except that there's so few times that anybody new walks in that they're just like, they've got their heads in their hands and they're bored stiff because they're not actually playing the game because it's not their money. They're just props. But yeah, his whole attitude of like, you're stupid to play this, stop trying to get me to play this, because he's trying to resist it, should be a good aspect to his character. In a different picture, would have been a complex, interesting portrayal of a character. There's a tiny moment where when he's about to sneak out on Goldie in the train car, he stops and he just looks at her. He actually cares for her. He's just not willing to get married. He's not willing to do this thing. There are actually lots of aspects of the character that are interesting, but the script doesn't flesh them out fully. It's not actually a good character script. Mm. And so he does interesting bits of acting here and there, but it's not a consistent character throughout the whole movie. And so it doesn't work that way. It only works as moments of cartoon over the course of a script where there could have been a character with a different director doing it.
I mean, I don't think it needed to be like a character-driven film, but I think if more of the jokes had hit, it could have been a better experience. Whereas for me, in Sheriff, just a higher percentage of the jokes hit. That's all.
Excellent. Well, we've covered a bunch of moments. We've even said a couple more. Let's move on to the quiz.
No.
Anna, I have some good news for you.
What's that?
You already have a bonus point.
I do. Why?
Because random.org's random number generator picked minute number 33. Minute number 33 is Latigo breaking the finger of the gunslinger in the store.
Oh my god.
And you, while you definitely went over 30 seconds, unprompted, perfectly described the details of that scene, and it would be churlish not to give you an unprompted bonus point for having remembered it without having rewatched the minute in such key detail.
Wow, I really earned that one, huh?
You really did earn that one. And to peel back the curtain a little bit, you revealed to me half an hour before we were scheduled to begin recording that you did not write a quiz for me this week. So I spent 15 minutes writing a 3-question quiz for you.
This is my new tactic.
This is the great thing about this.
Easier questions.
You have a bonus point. And you only need to get 2 out of 3 to win, which means you are halfway to victory because of the reduced emergency quiz.
I did suggest that we could just not do a quiz this time.
The people demand that we stick to the format.
All right. Well, let's see what hell you have to rot.
Question number 1. The character of the gunslinger, Colorado, is played by Ben Cooper.
Colorado McGee?
Colorado McGee? According to the commentary track by Michael Schlesinger, Cooper is a sly cameo, with audience expected to recognize him from what previous role? A. played the character of Turkey Ralston in Johnny Guitar in 1954. B, he played the part of Johnny Shattuck in Duel in Apache Wells in 1957. Or C, he played the part of Breck in 3 episodes of Gunsmoke in 1965. Which one of those 3 parts is this character in Support Your Local Gunfighter an homage? Unfortunately, it is A. Turkey Ralston, his breakthrough role in Johnny Guitar. Question number 2. At the end of the scene, it's revealed that Colorado is left-handed, and therefore they need to break his other finger. Which one of these key problems arises when shooting left-handed guns in a right-handed world? A. The safety and magazine releases on an automatic and semi-automatic are designed for the thumb of the right hand. B. The brass ejection of shells from an autoloader is aimed towards your face if you're holding it in your left hand, but away from your head if you're holding it in your right. Or C. The handedness is less important, and it's actually the dominant eye that's more important.
A.
Trick question. All 3 were correct. So, with a solid 2 points in victory guarantee, here is bonus question number 3. Let's see if you can get 3 points. According to names.org, the name Colorado is incredibly unusual, and fewer than 100 boys have had that name since 1880 in the United States. There are only 2 other states beginning with the letter C, California and Connecticut. Of those 3 names, rank them as to which has had the greatest number of boys with that name.
California, Colorado, Connecticut.
Unfortunately, the amount of boys named those is Colorado, then Connecticut, then California in decreasing order.
Who would name their kid Connecticut?
Also, fewer than 100 people since 1880, but more girls were named of those fewer than 100.
Sorry to all those Connecticuts out there.
Very, very, very few people. So, at the end of that abbreviated mini quiz, you have an unassailable 2 points. So congratulations on successfully manipulating the system in order to have a guaranteed win.
Oh, I look forward to doing it again.
And I'll merely mention that you won last time as well, which is why you're supposed to be making the quiz this time.
Have you ever...
So, you know, add it to your workflow.
Okay.
Have I ever what?
I mean, I don't know. Do you ever listen to, like, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and think, no one likes this?
I have reached a point with the quizzes on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It depends on which quiz you're getting asked. Like, the end quizzes where they're just straight-up trivia questions and you're trying to say what the right answer is. I love those. I mean, that's the kind of quiz that I'm trying to make here, where you're trying to figure out, based on a tiny sliver of knowledge, what the right answer is. It's the news stories, the fake news stories, where you're basically listening to creative writing and you're not sure who's a better liar. Like, I think those are the quizzes that aren't fair, because that just has to do with personality and vocal performance. That's less about knowledge. I do legitimately think about quiz design all the time in terms of the way in which sometimes if there's a right answer, people therefore write variations on the right answer. And so you can deduce what the right answer is based on the fact that there's one normal one and then 3 sort of abnormal ones around it. And that therefore the good way to trick people in writing a quiz is that you have the right answer, and then you come up with a wrong answer, and you write the other 2 options around the wrong answer, so that's the one that looks like it's the one that has an orbit around it.
Oh my god. No wonder these are so hard. You're a maniac.
You know, I have been working in education for 20 years. I do think about the idea of the structure of standardized tests and, like, what is the right way to ask people questions and that sort of thing. And I hope what I'm trying to do is make it so that it's a level playing field of you legitimately don't know what the right answer is.
Mm. Well, I think you succeed.
What I'm unfair about is that I'm always changing, like, the number of options. Like, sometimes it's three, sometimes it's five, sometimes it's three, and then all of the above or none of the above. Like, I don't have a consistent metric in terms of what your percentage chance of guessing between four probable options is. So if you legitimately don't know, which is what I assume everybody who's answering the question is, it's like they're just guessing. Maybe it should only ever be three options so that you have a 30% chance no matter what.
Hmm.
That might be the fair thing to do.
Fair schmear. I can't believe that I described the random minute. True randomness. It would happen eventually.
It's true. Out of the 92 minutes in the movie, the fact that you were like, there are no good moments in this. And then after talking about it for another 15 minutes, you're like, actually, wait, I just have one more that I want to mention. And it happened to land on 23. No, it wasn't. It was 33. But otherwise, it would have been perfect if it was the roulette wheel of moments. You have just had your James Garner unearned victory at the end of this episode.
I feel like we can't end our conversation about this movie without talking about the 1990s Maverick movie, which I grew up watching and I loved so very much, and I didn't realize how hot James Garner was. Because he was much older when that movie came out, and so I had a crush on Mel Gibson because I didn't know
that he was a creepy anti-Semite raised by a conservative post-Catholic father in Australia and California.
Yeah, poor guy. So I didn't know. There's so much I didn't know. He's just a young kid. But I did know that Maverick was and is a great movie.
Did you rewatch it for this?
No, you're
just coasting on memories.
Yeah, I ran out of time. It's one of the things that I own on VHS. It's one of my prized possessions. I have an old tube TV with a VHS player, a VCR, if you will,
Thank you.
So welcome. So maybe I'll fire that up today. Maybe I'll get in the bath and set up the TV and rewatch that, because, like, okay, so movies that you love when you're a kid don't always hold up. I get it. But, I mean, that movie was great. And it's nice to understand, like, what some of the source material is.
Yeah, and so I did find that DVD that had three random selections from the Maverick television show, which I believe ran for five seasons, and which Garner was excited to quit from after a lawsuit because he discovered that they weren't paying him very well. They had him as a classic studio contract, and not everybody else that was on the show did. So in order to make as many episodes as they wanted to make, they hired somebody to play Bart Maverick, his brother. So he was Brett Maverick, but he had a brother named Bart who was played by an actor whose name I'm not going to be able to remember, James something. That can't be right. And he was getting paid more than Garner was, despite the fact that Garner was lead in the credits, and a lot of people felt betrayed when it was a brother-centric episode. And so after two seasons of this, he sued Warner Brothers and eventually won and was able to be released from his contract and promptly quit like crazy. But that's why one of the aspects of William Goldman's script for the Maverick movie is the fact that everybody keeps on calling Maverick Bert and Bart and all these other names that aren't Brett Maverick, is because there were all these other Mavericks on the show that aren't in the film. And so it's a little homage to all of the other people that they brought on after Garner left the show to try and keep the franchise going.
Weird. It's a weird thing that they did.
I mean, was hugely successful.
I guess.
You know, why kill the goose that's laying the golden eggs?
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
Garner was involved in a very high-profile lawsuit for the Rockford Files later on, too. I mean, for a guy who's universally beloved, by most of his people that he worked with over the course of his long career. He was in extraordinarily well-publicized lawsuits where he was basically like, you should be paying more and more money. And the fact that he did it in such a way that didn't make him come across in the public perception as money-grubbing, as petty, that he instead was viewed as a workhorse and somebody who deserved that instead of somebody who was just trying to get through the system is pretty extraordinary in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, if his personality in real life is anything like his personality in Sheriff and like the one Maverick episode that I saw, the TV episode that I saw, Gunfighter excluded.
Coming later this year, September 16th is the 15th anniversary of his return to television after Maverick, before he comes up with the Rockford Files. It's a one-season wonder of a show called Nichols. And Nichols is an attempt to modernize the sheriff drama. He plays the main character, Nichols, who has a Model T Ford and a very early version of a motorcycle. Because it takes place in 1915, but he's basically out west just as the old west is dying and the country is starting to become uniform. He was a producer on the show, and he hired a bunch of the people that ended up being the people that worked for him on Rockford Files, and he was incredibly proud of it. But it wasn't getting the ratings that he thought it deserved. They were playing with the schedule and the title of it and messing around with it. And so he had his writers kill him off in the final episode so they wouldn't be able to renew it.
One and done. Well, you know, I like my Westerns, so I'm going to cover that later this year.
All right. I'll look into it. It's not cheap, but it is available.
Not cheap.
I mean, $40 for 24 episodes or whatever it is.
Dang.
Could be worse.
They must be really good.
that's
how that works.
Really,
right?
Unknown, and therefore there isn't much of a market for it.
It's not a streaming free on Netflix.
It's not. It's available on DVD on demand from Warner Brothers
Archives.
Warner Archive. Well, there's no financial reason to keep this in print, and so we will only make it when somebody asks us to.
Do you have like some secret librarian like access? You can just like email somebody and they send you like archival footage of whatever you want to see.
Were the country open, traditionally one of the things that people used to do before the advent of DVDs is they would go to the museum of not the Museum of the Moving Image, but there's the television archives in Queens. And that's like sometimes the only surviving records and things on tape. And they would just go to one of the viewing rooms and they would watch old episodes of television that were recorded off of television and take notes on it, because that was the only way to see some of these things.
That's very cool.
I've thought about doing it a long time. I just haven't had anything that's been needy enough for me to, like, you know, make an appointment to go there and
I'm shocked and disappointed that you haven't done it yet, and I can't wait for them to reopen.
It took me like 3 years to finally go to New York City just to sit down with the box of stuff from the estate of Peter Stone and read his first draft scripts of Sherrod. Like, I wanted to do it forever, ever since I found out that they had his archive files in the Library of Film and Television. But every time I went to New York, I was doing stuff. And so this one time, right before the big Pando shutdown, I was going into New York for February break, and I ended up with an extra day because some tickets that I had got rescheduled. I was like, I guess I have to stay a second day in New York City, which I know what I'll do. And I went to the New York Public Library, and I looked at old Sherrod scripts for 6 hours.
And could you tell the difference between the drafts?
Oh my god. I have
Ben's
so many photographs.
Ben's eyes got so big for our audio listeners.
None of this is making it into the episode, Hannah. It's
no,
just not stopping.
So good. Okay, so go on. There was a difference. You could tell. It was dramatic.
Oh yeah. There's just dumb things. Characters' names that were different, little pieces of dialogue, all kinds of things. And yeah, literally, like, I can't bring myself to delete these photos from my phone. I have, like, 60 photos, a of just letterheads from the film's company.
Oh, cool.
But also contracts and all sorts of just detritus. All right, so here's the thing. The very final scene is they go into the office and he's still pretending to be a master jewel thief that wanted to get the money. And so he's like, oh, I can't bear to see you turn over the stamps to the CIA. Look, I'm going to wait out here in the hallway. And she goes in to the secretary and says, I need to meet with Mr. Crookshank. And she goes, okay, go in. He's in the office. And she opens the door, and there's Cary Grant sitting there at his CIA desk. He's been undercover the whole time. And every time she's discovered another one of his Russian doll of identities, she's discovered that there he has a different name. Mm. And so she starts off meeting him, and he's Peter Joshua, but then she thinks he's Alexander Dial, and then she finds out that he's something else. And so here's the line. Well, what's your first name today? And he says, Burton. And she's like, Burton Crookshank? You'd serve me right if that's the one I got stuck with. And in the final making of the movie, they're like, we can't have it be Burton Crookshank, so he's Brian Crookshank. But I just love that. I just love the weirdness of, like, yeah, they wanted to go so far into bizarre that they named him Burton Crookshank. So I had to take a photograph of it. It's that sort of thing.
That's awesome. Also, to, like, look at something that you know so well, where you're like, no way, like, just from memory, like, you know the differences.
I own 14 copies of this movie on DVD.
Are there any versions that you don't own?
Oh, yeah. There are, like, seven.
Seven more that you don't own?
There's a weird quirk in the copyright law that they didn't do. Seriously, I can be so boring about this movie. This is why this is not going to make it into the episode. They didn't release the movie with the proper legal notification of copyright, which therefore the second it was published, accidentally released it into the public domain. And so they were able to, you know, obviously make money on the picture. But with the sudden advent of home video, it meant that if anybody had a master copy of it on 16 millimeter, they could digitize it and make their own DVDs and sell them, because nobody owned the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so every crappy $4.99 7-Eleven DVD company found a shitty print of Sherrod and made their own special edition Audrey Hepburn Cary Grant movie. And they all had the following special features. Digitally remastered, 2.1 surround sound, cast and crew credits. But almost all of them have the worst sound you've ever heard.
Really?
And, like, I was enjoying finding them. I was enjoying finding as many crappy bargain basement versions of this movie that I could get my hands on, just to, like, listen to the sound engineering and try to figure out which was the worst one. Like, I had a whole plan. I bought Sherrod.info because I planned on having a comprehensive database of all the crappy DVDs that were out there.
I love it when you, like, really out-nerd yourself. Like, I think I have it on VHS. I apparently need to rewatch it. Maybe I can do a Maverick Sherrod double feature.
Yeah. And if we do this for another couple of years, it will be the 60th anniversary in 2023.
First Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. The logo is based on designs by Leon Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced from clips on archive.org, which we believe are either in the Creative Commons or altered enough for creative fair use. All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. You can find us at farceperspective.com, and we're also on Blue Sky under the username farceperspective.com. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest in contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we consider another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.